in Richmond, Virginia, where he had gone to high school for 2 years. Daniel had attended Towson University and majored in secondary education with a minor in English. The year after graduation, he'd lost both parents in a car accident. The driver that had hit them was killed as well. His blood alcohol concentration had been 0.21. 5 months after the funeral, Daniel's brother was convicted on drug charges, manufacturing methamphetamine and dealing to minors, and sent to serve a 9-year sentence with the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Daniel had married a year later, then gotten a divorce 2 years after that. The ex had remarried almost as soon as the rushed divorce was final, and she'd produced a child with the new husband, a lawyer, 6 months after the wedding. Not terribly hard to read between the lines on that one. During that same year, the brother died in a prison fight. A very long, rough patch. Daniel currently taught history and English at a high school in what most people would consider the wrong part of D.C. He also coached girls volleyball and oversaw the student council. He'd won Teacher of the Year, a student voted award, twice in a row. For the past 3 years since the divorce, Daniel had spent his summers working with Habitat for Humanity, first in Hidalgo, Mexico, then in El Minya, Egypt. The third summer, he'd split his time between the two. No pictures of the deceased parents or brother. There was one of the ex, a formal wedding portrait of the two of them together. She was dark-haired and striking, the focal point of the photograph. He seemed almost like an afterthought behind her, though his wide grin was more genuine than the expression on her carefully arranged features. Alex would have liked the file to be more filled out, but she knew that, with her detail-oriented nature, she sometimes expected too much of less obsessive analysts. On the surface, Daniel was totally clean. Decent family. The self-destructive cycle that had led to the brother's death was easy enough to understand in light of the parents' crash. The victim in the divorce, not uncommon for the spouse of a crusading teacher to realize that the salary would not support a lavish lifestyle. Favorite of the underprivileged kids. Altruist in his free time. The file didn't state what had first caught the government's attention, but once they'd scratched that surface, the dark came seeping out. It seemed to have begun in Mexico. They hadn't been watching him then, so it was only the bank numbers that told the story. The forensic accountants had put together a well-documented history. First, his own bank balance, which had sat at just a couple of $100s after the divorce, was suddenly plus 10 grand, and then a few weeks later, another 10. By the end of the summer, it was 60 total. He went back to work in the States, and the 60 grand disappeared. Maybe a down payment for a condo, a fancy car? No, nothing visible, nothing on the record. The next year, while he was in Egypt, there were no sudden increases in his finances. Had it been gambling? An inheritance? That alone wasn't enough to catch anyone's attention without some kind of a tip-off, but she couldn't locate the catalyst in the file. Even with an explicit tip, someone in the accounting department had to have been putting in overtime or else was very, very bored because, despite the lack of urgency, the financial analyst had hunted down that original $60,000 like a bloodhound with his nose to the ground. Eventually he found it, in a new bank account in the Caymans, along with another $100,000. At this point, Daniel's name was put on a list. Not a CIA or FBI or NSA list, an IRS list. Not even a high priority list at that. His name wasn't very near the top. He was just someone to look into. She wondered for a moment how his brother's death had affected him. It looked like he had logged some fairly consistent visits to the brother, his only family left. Wife runs out, brother dies. Seemed like a decent recipe for pushing someone deeper into his bad choices. The money kept growing, and it was in no way consistent with what a drug mule or even a dealer might make. Neither job was so well compensated. Then the money started to move, and became harder to trace, but it added up to about $10 million in Daniel Beach's name, bouncing around from the Caribbean to Switzerland to China and back again. Maybe he was a front, with someone using his name to hide assets. But as a general rule, the bad guys didn't like to put those kinds of funds into the hands of unwitting schoolteachers. What could he be doing to earn it? Of course, they were watching his associations at this point, and it paid off quickly. Someone named Enrique de la Fuentes showed up in a grainy black and white photo taken by the security camera in the parking lot of Daniel Beach's motel in Mexico City. She'd been out of the game for a few years, and this name didn't mean anything to her. Even if she had still been with the department, it probably wouldn't have been a part of her usual caseload. She had done some occasional work on the cartel problem, but drugs never got the red lights flashing and the sirens screaming the way potential wars and terrorism did. De La Fuentes was a drug lord, and drug lords, even the scrappy, upwardly mobile kind, rarely got any attention from her department. Generally, the U.S. government didn't much care if drug lords killed each other, and usually those drug wars had very little impact on the life of an average American citizen. Drug dealers didn't want to kill their customers. That wasn't good for business. She had never, in all her years, even with the high security clearance that was a necessary part of her job, heard of a drug lord with an interest in weapons of mass destruction. Of course, if there was a profit to be made, you couldn't count anyone out. Profiting from the sale of was quite a different kettle from unleashing, though. De La Fuentes had acquired a medium-sized Colombian outfit in a hostile, to put it mildly, takeover in the mid-1990s, and then made several attempts to establish a base of operations just south of the Arizona border. Each time, he'd been repelled by the nearby cartel that straddled the border between Texas and Mexico. He'd become impatient and started looking for more and more unorthodox methods to dispose of his enemies. And then he'd found an ally. She sucked in a breath through her teeth. This was a name she knew. Knew and loathed. Being attacked from the outside was horrific enough. She felt the deepest revulsion for the kind of person who was born to the freedom and privilege of a democratic nation and then used that very privilege and freedom to attack its source. This domestic terrorist ring had several names. The department called them the Serpent, thanks to a tattoo that one of their late chiefs had possessed, and the line from King Lear. She'd been instrumental in shutting down a few of their larger conspiracies, but the one they'd accomplished still gave her the occasional nightmare. The file didn't say who had made the first contact, only that an accord had been reached. If De La Fuentes did his part, he would receive enough money, men, and arms to take out the larger cartel, and the terrorists would get what they wanted. Destabilization of the American nation, horror, destruction, and all the press they'd ever dreamed of. It was bad. Because what was better for destabilization than a deadly laboratory-created influenza virus, especially one you could control? She could tell when the narrative shifted from the analyst's point of view to the spies. Much clearer pictures. The spies were calling it TCX-1, no notation in the files on what the letter stood for, and even with her rather specialized background in medicine, she had no idea. The government was aware that the TCX-1 superflu existed, but they thought they eradicated it during a black ops raid in North Africa. The lab was destroyed, the responsible parties apprehended, and executed for the most part. TCX-1 hadn't been heard of again. Until it showed up in Mexico a few months ago, along with a supply of the life-saving vaccine, already incorporated into a new designer drug. She was starting to get a headache, the kind that was extremely localized. It was a hot needle stabbing directly behind her left eye. She'd slept a few hours after checking in and before diving into the files, but it hadn't been enough. She made the short walk to her toiletry bag beside the sink, grabbed 4 Motrin, and swallowed them dry. She realized 2 seconds later that her stomach was totally empty, and the Motrin would no doubt burn a hole through the bottom as soon as it hit. In her bag, she always had a stash of protein bars, and she quickly gnawed her way through one as she returned to her reading. The terrorists knew they were always being watched, so what they'd given De La Fuentes was information. De La Fuentes would have to provide the manpower, preferably innocuous, unremarkable manpower. Enter the school teacher. From what the best analytical minds could piece together, Daniel Beach, all-around good guy, had gone to Egypt and acquired TCX-1 for a hungry, unstable drug lord. And he was clearly still part of the plot. From the evidence available, it appeared he would be the one dispersing TCX-1 on American soil. The inhalable designer drug containing the vaccine was already in circulation. Valued customers would never be in danger, and perhaps this was a second part of the plot. Even the most unstable drug lord had to be pragmatic where money was concerned, so maybe non-customers would learn just where salvation waited, and that would create a whole new desperate clientele. Daniel Beach was no doubt immune by now. It wasn't a difficult job to circulate the virus. It would be as simple as wiping an infected swab across a surface that was regularly handled, a doorknob, a countertop, a keyboard. The virus was engineered to spread like the proverbial wildfire. He wouldn't even need to expose that many people. Just a few in Los Angeles, a few in Phoenix, a few in Albuquerque, a few in San Antonio. Daniel already had hotel reservations in each of these cities. He was due to embark on his deadly journey, ostensibly to visit more Habitat for Humanity sites, as a preparation for next fall's school field trip, in 3 weeks. The Serpent and De La Fuentes were attempting to orchestrate the most debilitating attack that had ever been perpetrated on American soil. And if it was true that De La Fuentes already had the weaponized virus and the vaccine, they had an excellent chance of success. Karsten hadn't been kidding. What she'd originally thought had been an act to play to her sympathies now appeared to be an amazing demonstration of self-control. Of all the potential disasters that had crossed her desk back when she'd had a desk, this was one of the very worst, and she'd seen some bad things. There had even been one other biological weapon with the potential to do this kind of damage, but that one had never made it out of the lab. This was a feasible plan already in progress, and it wasn't hundreds of thousands of people dying they were talking about here. It would be closer to 1 million, maybe more, before the CDC could get control of the situation. Karsten had known she would discover that fact. He deliberately downplayed the disaster so that it would sound more realistic. Sometimes the truth was worse than fiction. The stakes were higher than she'd expected. This knowledge made it harder for her to justify her own little low-stakes game. Was the tight focus on saving her own life even defensible in the face of this kind of horror? She'd held a hard line in her conversation with Karsten, but if there was any chance this story was more than a trap, did she have any choice but to try to stop it? If Daniel Beach disappeared, De La Fuentes would know someone was onto him. Odds were, he would act sooner than he'd planned, ahead of schedule. Daniel had to talk, and he had to talk quickly. And then he had to go back to regular life, be seen, and keep the megalomaniac drug lord calm until the good guys could take him out. In the beginning, it was standard operating procedure for Alex's subjects to be released into the wild for a short time. This was a major part of her specialty. Alex was the best at retrieving information without damaging the subject. Before Alex, Barnaby had been the best and only man for the job. The CIA, the NSA, and most similar government sections had their own teams for interrogating subjects who were slated for disposal after the information was acquired. Over time, as she proved more successful than even the best of the other teams, Alex had gotten a lot busier. Though the other sections would rather have stayed insular, kept the information with their own people, the results spoke for themselves. She sighed and refocused on the now. 11 pictures of Daniel Beach lay in a row across the pillows at the head of the bed. It was hard to reconcile the two sides of the coin. In the early pictures, he looked like a Boy Scout, his softly waving hair somehow projecting innocence and pure intentions. But though it was obviously the same face in the spy's photos, everything was different. The hair was always hidden under hoods or ball caps, one of her own frequent disguises. The posture was more aggressive, the expressions were cold and professional. She'd worked on professionals. It took time, possibly more than one weekend. She looked at the two matching but contradictory faces again and wondered briefly if Daniel had an actual psychiatric disorder or if it was a progression she was looking at and the innocent no longer existed at all. Not that it mattered. Yet. The headache felt like it was searing a hole through the inside of her eyeball. She knew it wasn't the hours of reading that had caused it. No, the decision looming in front of her was the source of the pain. She gathered up all the files and stuffed them into a suitcase. The decimation of the population of the American Southwest would have to take a back seat for a few hours. She was in a different car than she'd started out with that morning. Before checking into the motel, she'd returned the rental in Baltimore, then taken a cab to York, Pennsylvania. The cabbie dropped her a few minutes' walk from the house where a man surnamed Stubbins was selling his 3-year-old Tercel, as advertised on Craigslist. She'd paid cash and used the name Corey Howard, then driven to Philly in her new ride. It was a trail that could be followed, but it would be very hard to do. She drove several miles away from her motel, then chose a little dive that seemed to be doing brisk business. That was desirable for two reasons. One, she would be less memorable in a crowd. Two, the food was probably edible. The dining area was packed, so she ate at the small bar. The wall behind the bar was mirrored. She could watch the door and front windows without turning around. It was a good perch. She had a greasy burger, onion rings, and a chocolate malt. All were delicious. While she ate, she turned off her brain. She'd gotten pretty good at that over the last 9 years. She could compartmentalize almost anything. And while she focused on the food and watched the people around her, the headache subsided to a dull throb. Over the course of the meal, the Motrin finally won, and the pain dissolved completely. She ordered a piece of pie for dessert, pecan, though she was completely stuffed and could only pick at it. She was stalling. Once the meal was over, she'd have to make a decision. The headache was waiting for her in the car, as she'd known it would be, though it was not as sharp as before. She drove randomly down the quiet residential streets where anyone following her would be obvious. The little suburb was dark and empty. After a few minutes, she wandered closer toward the city. There were still two columns of possibilities in her head. The first column, that Karsten had been lying in order to lure her to her death, was beginning to seem more and more unlikely. Still, she had to stay alert. This whole story could be fiction. All the evidence and coordinating departments and separate analysts with their different writing styles and the photographs from around the world, it could be a very detailed, elaborate setup. Not a foolproof one either, since they had no way of knowing she wouldn't just walk away from it. But why would Karsten have all this info prepared if he'd hoped to get her to a prearranged meeting? They could have killed her easily there without all this window dressing. A ream of blank paper was all you would need if you expected your Mark's brains to be on the pavement before she could open the briefcase. How quickly could this kind of thing be thrown together? She'd given him no time to manufacture it on the spot with her early arrival. Who was Daniel Beach in this scenario? One of their own? or an unsuspecting civilian photoshopped into the exotic scenes. They had to know she would be able to verify some of this information. They'd offered her a plan of action in the final file. In 5 days' time, with or without her, they would pick him up during his regular Saturday morning run. No one would miss him until school began again Monday. If anyone did happen to look for him, it might appear that he'd taken a little holiday. If she agreed to help, she would have 2 days to get the information they needed. Then she would be free to go. They hoped she would consent to keep in some form of contact. An emergency email address, a social network site, the classifieds even. If she didn't agree to the job, they would do their best without her. But trying to leave the informant physically unmarked would be slow. Too slow. Failure was hard to contemplate. She almost salivated at the thought of all the goodies waiting for her back at the lab, things she could never get her hands on out here in the real world. Her DNA sequencer and polymerase chain reactor. The already fabricated antibodies she could stuff her pockets with if the invitation was on the up and up. Of course, if Karsten was for real, she wouldn't need to steal those things anymore. She tried to imagine sleeping in a bed again, not carrying a pharmacy's worth of toxins on her body at all times, using the same name every day, making contact with other human beings in a way that left nobody dead. "Don't count on it," she told herself. "Don't let it go to your head and impair your judgment. Don't let hope make you stupid." As pleasant as some of her imaginings were, she hit a wall when she tried to visualize the steps she would need to take to make them happen. It was impossible to see herself walking back through the shiny steel doors into the place where Barnaby had died screaming. Her mind totally refused to construct the image. The lives of a million people were a heavy weight, but still an abstract idea in many ways. She didn't feel like anything could push her hard enough to get her through those doors. She would have to go around them, so to speak. Only 5 days. She had so much work to do. Chapter 4. This operation was murdering her nest egg. That thought kept circling in the back of her brain. If she lived through the next week and nothing changed in regard to her working relationship with the department, she was going to have serious financial issues. It wasn't cheap changing lives on a triannual basis. Just acquiring disposable funds in the first place had been a major procedure. She'd had money. The salary had certainly been a factor in her choice to do the job in the beginning, and earlier than that, she'd inherited a decent insurance payout when her mother had died. But when you work for powerful paranoids who probably noted in your file when you switch toothpaste brands, you can't just withdraw all your money and put it in a shoebox under the bed. If they weren't planning to do anything to you before, you might have just given them a motive. If they were, you just made them decide to accelerate their plans. You could try withdrawing all your money on the way out of town, but that limited your ability to pay for any advance preparations. Like so much of it had been, it was Barnaby's scheme. He kept her in the dark about the details to protect the friend or friends who helped him set it up. In the cafeteria, located a few floors up from the lab, she and Barnaby had let themselves be heard talking about a promising investment situation. Well, Barnaby had called it promising and worked to convince her of it. There was nothing remarkable about the conversation. Various versions of it were probably taking place by water coolers and several normal offices at the same moment. She played being convinced, and Barnaby loudly promised to set it up. She wired money to an investment firm, or a company that sounded very like an investment firm. A few days later, that money was deposited, minus a 5% commission, to compensate those friends for their time and risk, in a bank in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the name of Frederica Noble. She received notification of this new account in an unmarked envelope placed in a copy of Extranodal Lymphomas at the county library. An Oklahoma driver's license for Frederica Noble, with her own picture on it, was also in the envelope. She didn't know where Barnaby's drop was, She didn't know what his new name was going to be. She'd wanted them to leave together. The vast aloneness of running was already part of her nightmares then, but he had thought that unwise. They'd both be safer, separated. More investments, more little envelopes. A few more accounts were created for Freddie, but there were also accounts and IDs for Ellis Grant in California and Shay Marlowe in Oregon. All three identities were strong creations that would hold up under scrutiny. Freddie had been blown the first time the department found her, but this only made her more careful. Ellis and Shay were still safe. They were her prized possessions, and she used them carefully and sparingly so as not to contaminate them by any association with Dr. Juliana Fortis. She'd also started buying jewelry, the good stuff, and the smaller the better. Canary diamonds that looked to her eyes like nothing more than yellow sapphires, but that cost 10 times as much as their clear counterparts. Thick gold chains, heavy solid gold pendants, several loose gems she pretended to be planning to set. She knew all along that she would never get back half of what she paid, but jewelry could be carried easily and later converted to cash under the radar. From a payphone, Freddie Noble rented a small cabin just outside Tulsa, using a new credit card that would be paid from the Tulsa bank account. The cabin came with a sweet older landlord who sounded happy to bring in the boxes she mailed there, boxes full of the many things she would need when she walked away from her life as Juliana Fortis, everything from towels and pillows to her unset jewels to reflux condensers and boiling flasks, and collected his rent without commenting on her absence. She left a veiled hint here and there that she was planning to leave a bad relationship. It was enough for the landlord. She ordered supplies from library computers, giving an email address she never accessed on her laptop at home. She did everything she could to be ready, and then she waited for Barnaby to give the signal. In the end, he did let her know that it was time to run, but not the way they'd planned it. That money, so carefully hoarded for so long, was now flowing through her fingers like she was some entitled trust fund brat. One big spree in hopes of gaining her unlikely freedom, she promised herself. She had a few tricks for making real money, but they were dangerous, involving risks she could ill afford but would have no choice but to take. People needed medical professionals who would break the rules. Some just wanted a doctor who knew how to oversee the administration of a treatment that was not approved by the FDA, something they'd picked up in Russia or Brazil. And some people needed bullets removed but didn't want it done in a hospital, where the police would be notified. She'd maintained a floating presence on the web. A few clients had contacted her at her last email address, which was now defunct. She'd have to get back on the boards that knew her and try to get in touch with some contacts without leaving any new trails. It would be hard. If the department had found the emails, they probably knew about the rest. At least her clients understood. Much of the work she did for them ranged from quasi-legal to totally criminal, and they would not be surprised by occasional disappearances and new names. Of course, working on the dark side of the law added other dangers to her already overloaded plate. Like the mid-level mafia boss who found her services very convenient and thought she should set herself up permanently in Illinois. She'd tried to explain her carefully composed cover story to Joey Giancardi without compromising herself. After all, if there was money to be made by the sale of information, the mob wasn't exactly known for its loyalty to outsiders. But he was insistent, to put it mildly. He assured her that with his protection, she would never be vulnerable. In the end, she'd had to destroy that identity, a fairly well-developed life as Charlie Peterson, and run. Possibly there were members of the family looking for her too now. It wasn't something she lost sleep over. When it came to manpower and resources, the mob couldn't touch the American government. And maybe the mob didn't have time to waste on her anyway. There were lots of doctors in the world, all of them human and most of them corruptible. Now, if he'd known her real specialty, Joey G would have put up more of a fight to keep her. At least Joey G had been good for changing her jewels into cash. And the crash course in trauma medicine couldn't hurt. Another perk of working in the underground. No one got too upset about your low batting average. Death was expected, and malpractice insurance wasn't necessary. Whenever she thought of Joey G, she also remembered Carlo Aggi. Not a friend, not really, but something close. He'd been her contact, the most constant presence in her life then. Though he was stereotypically thuggish in appearance, he'd always been sweet to her, treated her like a kid sister. So it had hurt more than the others when she hadn't been able to do anything for Carlo. A bullet had lodged in his left ventricle. It was too late for Carlo, long before they'd brought his body to her. But Joey G had still been hopeful. Charlie had done good work for him in the past. He was philosophical when Charlie had pronounced Carlo dead on arrival.
Carlo was the best. Well, you win some, you lose some.
And then a shrug. She didn't like to think about Carlo. She would have preferred a few more weeks to think about other things, to fine-tune her scheme, consider her vulnerabilities, get the physical preparations perfect. But Karsten's plan gave her a deadline. She'd had to divide her limited time between surveillance and organizing a workspace, so neither had been perfectly done. It was likely that they'd be watching her in case she tried to make a move without them. After her early visit to Karsten, they would be anticipating it. But what choice did she have? Report for work as expected? She'd seen enough to bet that Daniel would follow the same pattern today as he had the past three. Something about his almost identical outfits, similar jeans, button-down shirt, casual sport coat, all featuring only minor differences in hues, made her suspect that he was a creature of habit in his public life. After school, he would stay past the final bell to talk to students and work on his lesson plan for the next day. Then, with several folders and his laptop in a backpack over his left shoulder, he would head out, waving to the secretary as he passed. He would walk 6 blocks and get on the subway at Congress Heights around 6, just as the commuting mayhem was at its worst. He had a straight shot up the Green Line to Columbia Heights, where his tiny studio apartment was located. Once there, he would eat a frozen dinner and grade papers. He went to bed around 10, never turning the TV on as far as she'd seen. It was harder to follow what happened in the morning. He had rattan shades that were basically translucent when lit from inside, but opaque in the morning sun. He hit the street at 5 for a morning run, returned an hour later, then left again after another 30 minutes, headed for the subway station 3 blocks away, longish curly hair still wet from his shower. 2 mornings ago, she'd followed his exercise route as best she could from a safe distance. He held a strong, fast pace, obviously an experienced runner. As she watched, she found herself wishing that she had more time to run. She didn't love running the way others seemed to. She always felt so exposed on the side of a road, no car to escape in. But it was important. She was never going to be stronger than the person they sent after her. With her short legs, she wouldn't be faster either, and there was no martial art she could learn that would give her an advantage over a professional killer. But endurance, that could save her life. If her tricks could get her past the crisis moment, she had to be able to keep going longer than the killer could keep chasing. What a way to die. Winded, muscles quitting, crippled by her own lack of preparation. She didn't want to go out that way. So she ran as often as she could and did the exercises she could manage inside her small homes. She promised herself that when this operation was over, she would find a good place to jog, one with plenty of escape routes and hidey holes. But his running route, like the apartment and the school, was too obvious a place to make her move. The easiest way to do this would be to grab him off the street as he was finishing his run, worn out and unfocused. But the bad guys would know this too. They would be prepared for her. The same was true for the walking portion of his journey to school, so it had to be the metro. They would know the metro was another possible option, but they couldn't cover every line, every stop, while also watching each leg of his commute. There were cameras everywhere, but there was only so much she could do about that. When it was over, her enemies would have a million clear shots of what her face looked like now, 3 years later. Not much change, in her opinion, but they would still, no doubt, update her file. That was all they would be able to do, though. Her former position with the department had given her enough familiarity with the mechanics of snatching a target off the street to know that the difficulties were a lot greater than the average espionage TV series would lead one to believe. The purpose of the Metro cameras was to help catch a suspect after the crime. There was no way they'd have the resources and manpower to act on the coverage in real time. So all the cameras could tell them was where she had been, not where she would be. And without that information, the footage was useless. All the usual discoveries the tapes could help with, who she was, where she'd gotten her information, what her motive was, were things they already knew. In any case, she couldn't think of a less risky option. Today, her name was Jessie. She went with a professional look, her black suit with the V-neck black tee underneath, and of course, the leather belt. She had another, more realistic wig, this one chin length and lighter, a mousy blonde-brown color. She held this back with a simple black headband and added glasses with thin metal rims that didn't make it look like she was hiding, but still subtly disguised the shape of her cheekbones and forehead. Her face was symmetrical with small features. Nothing stood out. She knew that as a general rule, people overlooked her. But she also knew she wasn't so generic-looking that someone specifically searching would fail to recognize her. She would keep her head down whenever she could. She brought a briefcase rather than her tote, the wooden details from her shoulder strap snapped into place on the handle of the briefcase. It was lined with metal, heavy, even when empty, and could easily be used as a bludgeon if necessary. The locket, the rings, but not the earrings. She would have to do a bit of manhandling, and the earrings wouldn't be safe. The shoe knives, the scalpel blades, the chapstick, the various sprays, almost full armor. Today, it didn't make her feel more confident. This part of the plan was far outside her comfort zone. Kidnapping wasn't something she'd ever imagined needing to do. In the past 3 years, she hadn't thought of a scenario that didn't boil down to either kill or escape. Jessie yawned as she drove through the dark streets. She'd not been getting enough sleep, nor was sleep going to figure largely in the next few days. She had a few substances that would keep her awake, but the crash could be delayed for only 72 hours at most. She would need to be hidden very well when that crash came. She hoped it wouldn't be necessary to use them. There were plenty of spaces available in the economy parking lot at Ronald Reagan. She pulled into one near the shuttle bus stop, where most people would want to park, and waited for the bus to arrive. She knew this airport better than any other. She felt a long-missing sense of comfort kick in, the comfort of familiar surroundings. Two other passengers showed up before the shuttle, both of them with luggage and tired faces. They ignored her. She rode the bus to Terminal 3, then doubled back on the pedestrian bridge to the metro stop. This route took her about 15 minutes at a brisk walk. Nice thing about airports, everyone walked fast. She debated wearing boots with wedge heels, going for a different height, but then decided she would be walking, and possibly running, if things went badly. Too much today. She wore the dark flats that were half sneaker. As she joined the crowd heading down to the metro platform, she tried to keep her face hidden as much as possible from the ceiling cameras. Using her peripheral vision, she searched for a likely group to join. Jessie was sure that the watchers would be looking for a lone woman. A larger group, any group, was a better disguise than makeup or a wig. There were several clusters of people heading to the tracks with her as the first wave of rush hour began to crowd the escalators. She chose a trio, two men and one woman, all in dark business suits and carrying briefcases. The woman had shiny blonde hair and was a good 9 inches taller than Jessie in her high-heeled, pointy-toed pumps. Jessie edged her way around a few other parties until she was somewhat hidden between the woman and the wall behind them. Any eyes examining the new quartet would naturally be drawn to the tall blonde. Unless those eyes were specifically looking for Juliana Fortis. Jesse's quartet moved purposely through the crowd, claiming a spot near the edge of the platform to wait. None of the others in the group seemed aware of the small woman moving in tandem with them. There were too many close-packed bodies for her proximity to be noticeable. The train raced into view, whipping past and then jerking to an abrupt stop. Jesse's group hesitated, looking for a less crowded car. She contemplated abandoning them, but the blonde was impatient too, and she forced her way into the negative space of the third car they considered. Jesse pushed in close behind the woman she'd been following, her body pressed against both the blonde and another, larger woman behind her. She would be all but invisible between them, uncomfortable as the position might be. They rode the yellow line up to the Chinatown station. There she left the trio and joined a new couple, two women who could have been secretaries or librarians in their buttoned-up blouses and cat-framed eyeglasses. They rode the green line together up to the Shaw Howard station. Jesse's head cocked in the direction of the shorter brunette, pretending to be absorbed in a story about last weekend's wedding reception that hadn't included an open bar of all the nerve. Mid-story, she left the secretaries on the train and melted into the crowd exiting the metro. She did a quick U-turn through the densely packed ladies' room and then joined the crowd heading down to the tracks for the next train. Timing would be everything now. She wouldn't be able to hide inside the herd. The shrill wail of the approaching train had Jessie's heart bouncing up into her throat. She braced herself. It felt like she was a sprinter crouched at the blocks, waiting for the gun to fire. Then, she shuddered at the metaphor in her head. It was only too possible that a gun was actually about to fire, but this one would have real bullets and wouldn't be aimed at the sky. The train shrieked to a stop, and she was on the move. Jesse power walked down the line of cars, elbowing through the flow of passengers as the doors whooshed open. Scanning as fast as she could, she searched for the tall frame with the floppy hair. There were so many bodies ducking past her, blocking her view. She tried to put a mental X through every head that didn't match. Was she moving too quickly? Not quickly enough? The train was leaving by the time she got to the last car, and she couldn't be positive he wasn't on it, but she didn't think he was. By her calculations of his last two arrivals, he was most likely on the next train. She bit her lip as the doors closed. If she'd blown this one, she'd have to try again on his next trip. She didn't want to have to do that. The closer the time got to Karsten's plan being put into action, the more dangerous this would be. Rather than linger in plain sight, she continued briskly toward the exit. She did another circuit through the restroom, wasting a little time pretending to check the makeup she wasn't wearing. After counting to 90 in her head, she rejoined the stream of commuters on their way to the tracks. It was even more crowded now. Jesse chose a spot close to a group of suited men at the far end of the platform and tried to blend in with the black fabric of their jackets. The men were talking about stocks and trades, things that seemed so far from Jesse's life that they might as well have been science fiction. The next train was announced and she got ready to walk and scan again. She stepped around the traders and examined the first car as it came to a stop. Moving fast, Jesse's eyes ran through the next car. Woman, woman, old man, too short, too fat, too dark, no hair, woman, woman, kid, blonde, the next car. It was like he was helping her, like he was on her side. He was right beside the window, looking out, standing tall, with the wavy hair very much in evidence. Jesse gave the rest of the occupants a quick once-over as she walked toward the open doors. Many business types, any one of them could have been hired by the department. But there were no obvious tells, no extra-wide shoulders that didn't quite fit into normal-sized suit coats, no earpieces, no bulges under the jackets, no eye contact between riders. No one wore sunglasses. "This is the part," she thought to herself, "where they try to bag us both and haul us back to the lab. Unless this is a setup, in which case Daniel and his innocent curly hair will be one of them. He might be the one to shoot me, or stab me. Or they'll try to get me off the train to shoot me somewhere in private, or they'll knock me out and throw me on the tracks. But if the story is all true, they'll want us both alive. They'll probably try something similar to what I'm about to do to Daniel. Then they'll cart me off to the lab, and my odds of ever walking out again are less than encouraging. 1,000 other bad endings raced through her head as the doors closed behind them. She walked quickly to stand beside Daniel, sharing the same pole for balance, her fingers close below his paler, much longer fingers. Her heart felt like someone was squeezing it in a tight fist. It got more painful in direct proportion to her proximity to the target. He didn't seem to notice her, still staring out the window with a faraway look, a look that didn't change as they pulled into the darkness of the tunnel, and he could see only reflections from inside the car. Nobody in the car made any move toward them. She couldn't see any of the other guy in Daniel Beach, the one she'd seen pictures of in Mexico and Egypt, the one who hid his hair and moved with aggressive assurance. The abstracted man next to her could have been an old world poet. He must be an incredible actor. Or was it possible that he was legitimately psychotic, suffering from dissociative identity disorder? She didn't know what to do with that. Jesse tensed as they neared the Chinatown stop. The train lurched into the station, and she had to grip the pole tighter to keep from swinging into Daniel Beach. Three people, two suits and one skirt, exited the train, but none of them looked at Jesse. They all hurried past, moving like they were late for work. Two more men got into the car. One caught Jesse's attention, a big man, built like a professional athlete, wearing a hoodie and sweatpants. He had both hands in the front pouch of the hoodie, and unless his hands were the size of shoeboxes, he was carrying something in them. He didn't look at Jesse as he passed her, just went to the back corner of the car and grabbed an overhead strap. She kept him in the corner of her eye in the reflection, but he didn't seem interested in either herself or the target. Daniel Beach hadn't moved. He was so absorbed in his distant thoughts that she found herself relaxing beside him, as if he were the one person on the train she didn't have to guard against. Which was foolish. Even if this wasn't a trap, even if he was exactly who she'd been told he was, this man was still planning to become a mass murderer in the very near future. The athlete pulled a boxy pair of headphones out of his sweatshirt's big pocket and covered his ears with them. The cord led back down to the pocket, probably to his phone, but maybe not. She decided to make the next stop a test. As the doors opened, she bent down as if to fix the non-existent cuff on her pants, then straightened suddenly and took a step toward the door. No one reacted. The athlete in the headphones had his eyes closed. People got on, people got off, but no one looked at her, and nobody moved to block her exit or suddenly brought up a hand with a jacket awkwardly draped over it. If her enemies knew what she was doing, they were letting her do it her way. Did that mean it was real, or that they just wanted her to believe it was for now? Trying to think around their circles made her head hurt. She grabbed the pole again as the train started moving.
Not your stop?
She looked up, and Daniel Beach was smiling down at her. The perfectly sweet, guileless smile that belonged to the school's most popular teacher, to the Habitat for Humanity crusader. No. She blinked, her thoughts scrambling. What would a normal commuter say?
I just forgot where I was for a minute. The stations all start to blur together. Hold on. The weekend is only 8 or 9 hours away.
He smiled again, a kind smile. She was more than uncomfortable with the idea of socializing with her subject, but there was a strange, possibly counterfeit, normality about Daniel that made it easier for her to assume the role she needed to play. Friendly commuter, ordinary person. She snorted a dark little laugh at his observation. Her work week was just beginning. That would be exciting if I got weekends off. He laughed and then sighed.
That's tough. Law?
Medicine.
Even worse. Do they ever let you out for good behavior?
Very rarely. It's okay, I'm not much for wild parties anyway.
I'm too old for them myself, he admitted. In fact, I usually remember around 10 o'clock every night.
She smiled politely as he laughed, and tried to keep her eyes from looking crazed. It felt both creepy and dangerous to be fraternizing with her next job. She never had any interactions with her subjects beforehand. She couldn't afford to look at him as a person. She would have to see only the monster, the potential million dead, so she could remain impassive.
Though I do enjoy the occasional quiet dinner out, he was saying.
She murmured distractedly. It sounded like an agreement, she realized.
Hi, he said. My name is Daniel.
In her surprise, she forgot what her name was supposed to be. He held out his hand, and she shook it, tremendously aware of the weight of her poisoned ring. Hi, Daniel.
Hi,
he raised his eyebrows. Alex. Whoops, that was a few names back. Oh, well.
Nice to meet you, Alex. Look, I never do this, ever, but, well, why not? Can I give you my number? Maybe we could have that quiet dinner sometime.
She stared at him in blank shock. He was hitting on her. A man was hitting on her. No, not a man. A soon-to-be mass murderer working for a psychotic drug czar. Or an agent trying to distract her.
Did I scare you? I swear I'm harmless.
Well, no one has ever asked me out on a train before. That was nothing but the plain truth. In fact, no one at all had asked her out for years. I'm at a loss.
Also true. Here, this is what I'll do. I'll write my name and number down on this piece of paper, and I'll give it to you. And when you get to your stop, you can throw it in the next trash can you see, because littering is wrong, and immediately forget all about me. Very little inconvenience to you. Just that extra few seconds with the trash can.
He smiled while he spoke, but his eyes were down, focused on writing his information on the back of a receipt with a number 2 pencil. That's very considerate of you. I appreciate it. He looked up, still smiling.
Or you don't have to throw it away. You could also use it to call me, and then spend a few hours talking to me while I buy you food.
The monotone voice overhead announced the Penn Quarter station, and she was relieved, because she was starting to feel sad. Yes, she was going to have a night out with Daniel Beach, but neither of them was going to enjoy it very much. There could be no room for sadness. So many innocent dead. Dead children, dead mothers and fathers. Good people who had never hurt anyone. It's a dilemma, she answered quietly. The train stopped again, and she pretended to be jostled by the man exiting behind her. The appropriate needle was already in her hand. She reached out as if to steady herself with the pole and grabbed Daniel's hand in a move designed to look accidental. He jerked in surprise, and she held on tight like she was trying to keep her balance. Ouch! Sorry I shocked you, she said. She released him and let the tiny syringe slide out of her palm into her blazer's pocket. Sleight of hand was something she'd practiced a lot.
No worries. You okay? That guy really knocked you.
Yes, I'm fine, thank you. The car started moving again, and she watched as Daniel's face quickly started to lose its color. Hey, are you okay? She asked. You look a little pale.
What?
He glanced around, confused. You look like you're going to pass out. Excuse me, she said to the woman in the seat beside them. Can my friend sit? He's not feeling well. The woman rolled her enormous brown eyes and then looked studiously in the other direction.
No, Daniel said. Don't bother about me,
Daniel? She asked. He was swaying a little now, his face dead white. Give me your hand, Daniel. Looking bemused, he held out his hand. She gripped his wrist, moving her lips in an obvious way as she looked at her watch and pretended to count to herself.
Medicine, he muttered. You're a doctor.
This part was closer to the scripted version, and it made her more comfortable. Yes, and I'm not pleased with your condition, You're getting off at the next stop with me. We're going to get you some air.
Can't. School. Can't be late.
I'll write you a note. Don't argue with me. I know what I'm doing.
Okay, Alex.
L'Enfant Plaza was one of the biggest and most chaotic stations on the line. When the door opened, Alex put her arm around Daniel's waist and led him out. He draped one arm over her shoulder for support. This didn't surprise her. The tryptamine she'd injected him with made people disoriented, acquiescent, and quite friendly. He would follow her lead as long as she didn't push him too hard. The drug was distantly related to a class of barbiturates that laypeople called truth serum, and that had a few effects similar to ecstasy. Both were good for breaking down inhibitions and inducing cooperation. She liked this particular synthesis because of the confusion. Daniel would feel incapable of decision-making and therefore would do whatever she told him to until it wore off, or unless she asked him to do something that really pushed against the walls of his comfort zone. This was easier than she'd hoped, thanks to the unexpected tête-à-tête. She'd planned to stick him, then play the old, "Is there a doctor in the house? Why, yes, I happen to be a doctor," routine to get him to go with her initially. It would have worked, but he would not have been this docile. "Okay, Daniel, how are you feeling? Can you breathe?"
"Sure. Breathing's good."
She walked quickly with him. This drug rarely made anyone sick, but there were always exceptions. She glanced up to check his color. He was still pale, but his lips hadn't taken on the greenish hue that would presage nausea. "Do you feel sick to your stomach?" she asked.
No, I'm fine."
"I'm afraid you're not. I'm going to take you to work with me, if that's okay. I want to make sure this isn't serious."
"Okay. No, I have school."
He was keeping pace with her easily, despite his disorientation. His legs were about twice as long as hers. "We'll tell them what's happening. You have a number for the school?"
"Yes, Stacy, in the office."
"We'll call her while we walk." This would slow them down, but there was no help for it. She had to allay his concern so he would stay docile.
"Good idea."
He nodded, then pulled an old BlackBerry out of his pocket and fumbled with the buttons. She took it gently from his hand. "What's the last name for Stacy?"
"It's under front desk."
"I see it. Okay, I'll dial for you. Here, tell Stacy you're sick. You're going to the doctor." He took the phone obediently, then waited for Stacy to answer.
"Hello," he said. "Stacy, I'm Daniel." "Yes, Mr. Beach." "Not feeling so good. Going to see Dr. Alex. Sorry, hate to dump this on you." "Sorry. Thanks." "Yes, get better for sure."
She flinched a little when he used her name, but that was just habit. It didn't matter. She wouldn't be Alex again for a while, that was all. It was a risk taking him out of school. Something De La Fuentes might notice if he was keeping close tabs on his messenger of death. But surely he would not raise the alarm to critical over one missed Friday. When Daniel showed up intact Monday morning, the drug lord would be reassured. She took the phone from Daniel and pocketed it. "I'll hold this for you, okay? You look unsteady and I don't want you to lose it."
"Okay."
He looked around again and frowned at the giant concrete ceiling arcing overhead.
"Where are we going?"
"My office, remember? We're going to get on this train now." She didn't see any faces from the other train in this car. If they were following, they were doing it from a distance. "Look, here's a seat. You can rest." She helped him settle, surreptitiously dropping his phone by her foot and then nudging it farther under the seat with her shoe. Tracking a cell phone was the very easiest way to find someone without having to do any work. Cell phones were a trap she'd always avoided. It was like volunteering to tag yourself for the enemy. Well, she also didn't really have anyone to call.
"Thanks," Daniel said.
He still had one arm around her, though now, with him sitting and her standing, it was at her waist. He stared up at her dizzily and then added,
"I like your face."
"Oh, thank you."
"I like it a lot."
The woman sitting next to Daniel looked over at Alex and examined her face. Great. The woman seemed unimpressed. Daniel leaned his forehead against her hip and closed his eyes. The proximity was disconcerting on a few different levels, but also oddly comforting. It had been a long time since any human being had touched her with affection, even if this affection had come out of a test tube. Regardless, she couldn't let him fall asleep yet. What do you teach, Daniel? He angled his face up, his cheek still resting on her hip.
Mostly English. That's my favorite.
Really? I was horrible at all the humanities. I liked science best. He made a face.
Science?
She heard the woman beside him mutter, drunk, to her other neighbor.
Shouldn't have told you I was a teacher, he sighed heavily.
Why not?
Women don't like that. Randall says never volunteer the information.
The way he said the words made it clear he was quoting this Randall verbatim. But teaching is a noble profession, educating the future doctors and scientists of the world. He looked up at her sadly.
There's no money in it.
Not every woman is so mercenary. Randall is dating the wrong type.
My wife liked money. Ex-wife.
Sorry to hear that. He sighed again and closed his eyes.
It broke my heart.
Another twinge of pity, of sadness. He would never say these things, she knew, if he weren't high on her ecstasy truth serum hybrid. He was speaking more clearly now. The drug wasn't wearing off, his mind was just adapting to working around it. She patted his cheek and made her voice cheery. If she was that easily bought, she probably isn't worth crying over. His eyes opened again. They were a very gentle hazel, an even mix of green and soft gray. She tried to picture them intense, fitting under the baseball cap of the self-assured man meeting with De La Fuentes in the photos, and failed. She didn't know what she would do if he actually had dissociative identity disorder. She'd never worked with that before.
You're right, he said. I know you are. I need to see her for what she really was, not what I imagined she was.
Exactly. We build up these ideas of people, create the one we want to be with, and then try to keep the real person inside the false mold. It doesn't always work out well.
Gibberish. She had no idea what she was saying.
She'd been in one semi-serious relationship in her whole life, and it hadn't lasted long. School had been prioritized before the guy, just like work had been prioritized before everything else for 6 years. Like how she now prioritized breathing over everything else. She had a problem with obsessiveness.
Alex?
Yes?
Am I dying?
She smiled reassuringly. No. If I thought you were dying, I would have called an ambulance. You'll be fine. I just want to double check.
Okay. Will I have to have blood taken?
Maybe. He sighed.
Needles make me nervous.
It will be fine. She didn't like that this bothered her, lying to him. But there was something about his simple trust, the way he seemed to ascribe the best motives to everything she did. She had to snap out of it.
Thank you, Alex. Really?
Just doing my job. Not a lie.
Do you think you'll call me?
He asked hopefully.
Daniel, we're definitely going to spend an evening together, she promised.
If he hadn't been drugged, he would have heard the edge in her voice and seen the ice in her eyes. Chapter 5. The rest went almost too smoothly. Did that mean something? Her paranoia level was already so high, it was hard to say if this new worry elevated it or not. He got into the cab at the Roslyn station without protest. She knew how he felt. She and Barnaby had tried out most of the non-lethal preparations to have some concrete experience with what they could do. This one was like dreaming a pleasant dream, where problems and worries were for someone else to figure out, and all one needed was a hand to hold and a nudge in the right direction. In their notes, they'd nicknamed it Follow the Leader, though it had a more impressive name on the official reports. It was a relaxing trip, and if it weren't for the fact that she desperately needed her inhibitions, even back then, she might have indulged again. She got him talking about the volleyball team he coached. He'd asked if he'd be back at school in time for practice, and he spent the entire cab ride telling her about the girls until she felt she knew all their names and their strengths on the court by heart. The cabbie paid no attention, humming along to some song too low for her to make out. Daniel seemed mostly oblivious to the travel, but at a particularly long red light, he looked up and frowned.
Your office is far away.
Yes, it is, she agreed. It's a hell of a commute.
Where do you live?
Bethesda.
That's a nice place. Columbia Heights is not so nice. My part of it, at least.
The cab started moving again. She was pleased. The plan was going very well. Even if they'd clocked her getting on and off the last train, they'd be hard-pressed to keep track of one cab in a sea of identical cabs, twisting together through rush hour. Preparation felt like a magic spell sometimes. Like you could force events into the shape you wanted just by planning them thoroughly enough. Daniel wasn't as talkative now. This was the second phase of the drug's action, and he would be getting more tired. She needed him to stay awake just a little bit longer. Why did you give me your number? She asked when his lids started to droop. He smiled dreamily.
I've never done that before.
Me either.
I'll probably be embarrassed about it later.
Not if I call you, though, right?
Maybe. I don't know. It was out of character.
So why did you do it? His soft eyes never left hers.
I like your face.
You mentioned that.
I really wanted to see it again. That made me brave.
She frowned, guilt pulsing.
Does that sound weird?
He seemed worried. No, it sounds very sweet. Not many men would tell a woman something like that. He blinked owlishly.
I wouldn't, usually. Too cowardly.
You seem pretty brave to me.
I feel different. I think it's you. I felt different as soon as I saw you smile.
As soon as I roofied you, she amended in her head. Well, that's quite a compliment, she said. And here we go. Can you get up?
Sure. This is the airport.
Yes, that's where my car is. His brow furrowed, then cleared.
Did you just get back from a trip?
I just got into town, yes.
I go on trips sometimes. I like to go to Mexico.
She glanced up sharply. He was staring ahead, watching where he was walking. There was no sign of distress on his face. If she pushed him toward a secret, anything that was a pressure point, his docility would turn to suspicion. He might latch on to another stranger as his leader and try to escape. He might get agitated and call attention to her. What do you like about Mexico? She asked carefully.
The weather is hot and dry. I enjoy that. I've never lived in a really hot place, but I think I would like it. I get burned, though. I've never been able to tan. You look like you've spent some time in the sun.
Nope, just born this way. She got her coloring from her absentee father. Genetic testing had informed her that he was a mix of many things, predominantly Korean, Hispanic, and Welsh. She'd always wondered what he'd looked like. The combination with her mother's Scottish background had created in her an oddly ordinary face. She could have been from almost anywhere.
That must be nice. I have to use sunblock. A lot of sunblock. Or I peel. It's disgusting. I shouldn't tell you that.
She laughed. I promise to forget it. What else do you like?
Working with my hands. I help build houses. Not in a skilled way. I just hammer where they tell me to, but the people are so kind and generous. I love that part.
It was all very convincing, and she felt a thrill of fear. How could he stick to the story so well, so effortlessly, with the chemicals moving through his system right now? Unless he'd built up a resistance somehow. Unless her department had created an antidote. Unless they'd prepped him, and he was playing her. The goosebumps stood up on the back of her neck. It didn't have to be the department that had prepared him. It could be his interactions with De La Fuentes. Who knew what kind of results strange drugs interacting with her own would have? She touched her tongue to the false cap on her back tooth. The department would have just killed her if that were the goal. De La Fuentes would probably want to punish her for attempting to interrupt his plans. But how would he know in advance? How could Daniel have made her as an opposing agent so quickly? She didn't even actually work for anyone anymore. Stick to the plan, she told herself. Get him in the car, and you're in the clear. Sort of.
I like the houses there, too, he was saying. You never close the windows, just let the air blow through. Some don't even have glass. It's a lot nicer than Columbia Heights, I can tell you. Maybe not nicer than Bethesda. I bet doctors live in nice houses.
Not me. Boring vanilla apartment. I don't spend much time there, so it doesn't matter. He nodded sagely.
You're out saving lives.
Well, not really. I'm not an ER doctor or anything.
You're saving my life.
Wide gray-green eyes. Total trust. She knew that if this behavior was genuine, it was the drug talking, but it still made her uneasy. She could only keep playing her role. I'm just checking up on you. You're not dying. That much was true. The boys back at the department might have ended up killing this man. At least she could spare him that. Though, after she prevented the catastrophe, Daniel Beach would never see the outside of a prison cell again. Which made her feel a million dead. Innocent, tiny babies. Sweet, elderly grandmas. The first horseman of the apocalypse on a white steed.
Oh, a bus too, he said mildly.
This one takes us to my car. Then you won't have to walk anymore.
I don't mind. I like walking with you.
He smiled down at her, and his feet tangled on his way up the steps. She steadied him before he could fall, then maneuvered him into the closest seat on the mostly empty bus.
Do you like foreign films?
He asked, apropos of nothing. Some of them, I guess.
There's a good theater at the university. Maybe if the dinner goes well, we could try some subtitles the next time.
I'll make a deal with you, she said. If you still like me after one evening together, I will definitely see a movie I can't understand with you. He smiled, his lids drooping.
I'll still like you.
This was totally ridiculous. There should have been some way to direct this conversation away from flirting. Why was she the one feeling like the monster here? Okay, she was a monster, but she'd come to terms with that, mostly. And she knew she was the kind of monster that needed to exist for the sake of the common good. In some ways, she was like a normal physician. She had to cause pain to save lives, like cutting off a gangrenous